morning. We call the Senate Revenue Committee to order. We will open this morning with reconsideration of House Bill 2449. We need a motion to reconsider.
Mr. Chairman, I move we suspend the rules so that for the purpose of reconsideration of House Bill 2449.
Senator Metzger has moved that we suspend the rules, reconsider previous vote by which we passed Senate Bill or House Bill 2449. Discussion. No opposition to this reconsideration. So ordered. All right, we.
Do you want me to speak to it, Senator Stoddard?
The motion to reconsider carries, and yes, okay. Would you?
Chairman Starr and committee members, with House Bill 2449, the only reason why it's coming back to you is because there were conflicts with another bill that we've already passed, and that was House Bill 2448. So basically, with House 2448, that permitted the Department of Revenue to refund amounts determined to be overpayments on the original tax returns, which were filed more than 3 years after the due date. So we've already passed that bill, so that was amending 314-415. So that's why you have this bill, which again is dealing with the apportionment of the tax refunds among the married couples, and now we're going to be making it based on adjusted gross income of each spouse, not the gross earnings reported by an employer. So that also is amending this statute. So that's why you have to have these conflict amendments, and again, as most of you know, conflict amendments are just trying to deal with the two legislation that have passed in this same session, and so we just need these amendments to make the two conflict and both become law if this gets passed and signed by the governor.
Any questions?
So it's an A3.
We need to move the A3 amendments into House Bill 2449.
Mr. Chair, I move that the A3 amendments to House Bill 2449 be adopted.
Senator Metzger has moved that the A3 amendments to House Bill 2449 be adopted. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Forward.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2449A as amended back to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved House Bill 2449 as amended back to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And if you correct this, Senator Prozanski was carrying it before, yep. So he's fine, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Senator Prozanski will
continue
as carrier of this important piece of legislation.
You know my record on the floor with these bills that we just continuously carry.
Stairs. I am aware. We're going to open the work session then on Senate Bill 479. And welcome the chair of the Senate Revenue to our committee, and I'll turn the gavel over to you, Mr. Chair.
You want to keep it?
No, you handle that very well.
So the complex. He just opened this work session before.
Paul, this is the Food Processors Bill Committee. I think we're really familiar with this proposal. They have been working with the governor's office. What do we have?
Mr. Chair, you have a -3 amendment. Mary has rushed back to the office to get some additional data for you. But the -3 amendment we just got this morning, it was based roughly on the amendment, the dash 2 that you saw before. Here she is. And the parties have just had a chance to look at it, so they'll be ready to comment on it.
So, Mr. Vice Chair and Committee, what I talked to the Senate President this morning. I've been out of town, just got back in. What he wants to do is hold on to all our tax credit bills, but I'd like us, if we could, to settle on which one of these we're most interested in today. So as we can go through the three different amendments that we have before us, hear from the parties that have been involved in this, and if we can get ourselves settled on which one we like the most, that would get us all set for the negotiations that are occurring on closing out the final budget. Mary, did you want to?
Give you an update.
Sure.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Senate Bill 479, and we've looked at this before. When we met before, we looked at the Dash 2 amendment, actually, and it was the intent is to provide a 5-year property tax exemption for purchases of new equipment by qualified companies. The qualified companies must be operating in one or more selected industries. Now, the initial bill, the original bill, had a listing, a long listing of processors of foods, and it listed them by NAICS, which are National American Industry Classification System coding references. And it listed beet manufacturing, frozen fruit juice, juice and vegetable manufacturing, frozen specialty food manufacturing, and fruit and vegetable canning. The intent of the bill is to stimulate these particular industries, and testimony was provided at our first public hearing that basically explained why the industries were failing in a global market. The Dash 3 amendment was requested because during the testimony that we had heard, there was a request to have a sunset provision put in the bill, and some of the people from the Department of Agriculture wanted to refine the Dash 2 amendment, clarify the language, and in so doing, they provided us with a different narrowed version, I would say, of the list of industries as relative to the initial bill, but it added to the Dash 2 amendment references to seafood processing, which is a large industry in the state. And so when we were done with the basically revenue impacts of the data, of the analysis, I brought my revenue impacts up from what had initially been in the Dash 2 amendment, a number of 0.67 million for 507, to what is currently a revenue estimate for 0507 of about 1.23 million. At the public hearing, testimony was also provided by the Department of Revenue, and John Phillips, I believe, or the revenue representative, was asked to see if they could find some additional information which would locate the site of some of these industries in the state. And I, huffing and puffing down here, I was trying to collect that data for you, which John sent me this morning, because he does have some data by county code, and I was trying to put the county names next to it so you could see where those industries are. But I can tell you that over for the data that was revealed in their process of selecting all these industries and locating them and looking back historically over 5 years, they came up with an estimate. Now, this is for 5 years worth of purchases of about $38 million per year, or $170 million in assessed value, which translates to about $500,000 per year. And my estimate is about $1.2 million per year. But his is based on historical data, and mine is based on fudging it from NAIC, code census data, employment data, and then growing it out. So I think our differences really come down to applying a growth rate. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
And we never admit to fudging it.
No.
impacts.
That's forecast.
What's the technical?
Forecast.
Forecast.
Yeah. Another word for fudge.
Mr. Vice Chair, are we in work session?
We're in work session.
We are. Let's hear Ms. Katie Koba. Ken, do you want to, representing the industry, Mr. Yates, and let's see, Gail, do you want to come up and talk about the county perspective, since it looks like we're mostly focused on property taxes, and y'all can update us on what happened this last week.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We've had a bonding experience during the last week. Spent way too much time on this topic. Mr. Chair and members, we've put a lot of hard work into the Dash 3 amendments and would recommend to you that those are the amendments that the committee considers. As staff has indicated, we have basically moved away from trying to define what we're talking about in terms of the NAICS codes and actually have some definitions now in the amendments that define food processing for the purposes of this property tax exemption and what kinds of processing we're looking at, and we're really focused on primary processing. So we have some language in the bill that defines our intent in terms of primary processing and the kinds of things that take place in that. Again, the focus is to try to incentivize the industry in the state in order to continue to remain competitive in a global economy, to make critical investments in machinery and equipment, technology, and those kinds of things so that they can compete. I do think in talking this morning and looking at the amendments real quickly, and I think both Ken and Gilt can speak to this, right now we have some of the processors that would qualify under this new language are in an existing enterprise zone. And enterprise zones have language that deal with machinery and equipment property tax exemptions. A 3-year exemption can apply and get a 5-year exemption. We wanted to make it clear for the record, and we think we probably may need a bit of statutory language to indicate we're not interested in having companies double dip in that they would get the exemption under the enterprise zone as well as qualify for an additional exemption under this bill. Our intention is that they would choose one or the other, and we didn't get that language in these amendments, so we probably need to work on that, and if the bill isn't moving today, we can do that real quickly. Other than that, I think we feel very good about the amendments as they are in front of you now, and I think I'd like to have Ken and Gil make their comments.
Great. Thanks, Katie. Any questions for the department? Good morning, Mr. Yates.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Ken Yates, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association. I want to echo Director Koba's comments. This has been a very productive and positive collaborative negotiation with the Departments of Agriculture, Revenue, Counties and Cities, County Assessors. I want to make it very clear for the record that the intent here is to fill the gap. Approximately half of the processors that would qualify under this very targeted and specific bill, the distressed sectors in fruit and vegetable, seafood, would be given the option of an enterprise zone if that option is open to them, and for about half those processors where there is not an enterprise zone designation, they would have this option. So we're just trying to fill the gap here. It's an either-or. It would be an election. It would not be double-dipping. That is not our intent. As I've repeatedly said in testimony before this committee and also before Senator Metzger's Business and Economic Development Committee, the whole thrust of this legislation is to address the distressed commodity processors and give them some capital in order to invest in the innovation and creation of new products, in technology that will increase productivity and provide higher skilled and higher wage jobs in the industry. So the intent of this legislation is to get these guys to get into value added, and I believe it does that. Clearly that isn't our intent. So if you have a company that is processing a commodity and they do a primary process and then they use that ingredient in a value added product at the same facility, they would be able to do that and invest, make the investments to do that by freeing up some capital under this bill. That is our intent. I feel very good about the product. Could use some additional tweaking, but I think we're very close, Mr. Chairman.
And you'll have time to, I think we're going to do our tax credits, anything with the T and the C in it, right at the very end of, so that should buy you, you tell me.
November?
Should buy you a little bit of time. But
in the meantime, and I don't know if it's possible to get, at least get the industry, and we'll hear from the counties and cities in a moment, if y'all could put out a joint letter and get to some of the members, if that's where you're at or when you get there, some sort of joint statement of the process. We're well aware of it on this committee, but some sort of statement about the iterations that this bill's been through and where you've landed, I think that would be helpful to educate at least the rest of the Senate, and maybe really helpful as you move over to the House.
Mr. Chairman, speaking for myself, I think we can easily do that, and I'll let Katie and Gil respond, but we can easily do that on our part.
Great. Mr. Riddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Let me make a small correction, Mr. Chair. It's not the C and the T and the C word anymore. It's the T and the E word, because these are property tax exemptions now instead of tax credits, which apply to the income tax. We see this as a promising effort for the food processors to stay in business and become competitive again. And we appreciate that it's precisely targeted. That was important to us, and that the administrative headaches are minimized. So we do support this, which is, as you know, we're hawks on new property tax expenditures. But in this instance, we are persuaded that it may well work. But we want to note for you that this is a switch from tax credits, which apply to the income tax, to tax expenditures, property tax exemptions. And that means you're spending local revenues for a statewide problem. And we want to note that on the record, that I think county officials deserve some credit for stepping up with this. We do consider these processors important to Oregon, but it is a statewide problem. And at some point, the state will have to also pitch in at certain points. At this point, we're happy to step up. But we also want to note that we take the the sunset date seriously, and we'll be watching to make sure this money is well spent. And with that, we are in record of support.
So, Gil, I think we came up with a 5-year sunset. Where are you guys at in terms of sunset to relook at this? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we conferred with the experts in the Department of Agriculture and in the industry, and they said that we asked, what about 3 years? Well, that isn't quite time enough to benchmark and to track it. But they convinced us that 5 years would be a clear, we know then if this money's well spent. So we went ahead with the 5-year.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, Ken Yates again. I'll be headed up to Olympia for a 2 o'clock signing ceremony with Governor Gregoire, who will be signing a $30 million tax relief package. That is a business and occupation tax exemption for the same segments of the industry until 2012, and also a sales and use tax exemption for the construction of new manufacturing space, cold storage space, and R&D space for the fruit and vegetable industry. And again, that's highly targeted, just fruit and vegetable for all of that. That's worth about $30 million over the next 4 years. She has already signed a $10 million unemployment insurance tax relief measure, again targeted for cold storage and food processors and agriculture. So the $10 million is our piece of that under UI. So Washington is moving today. And we're very encouraged by that. I would echo Gil's remarks and appreciate the collaboration we've had with the counties and the cities. And certainly, I appreciate the county's support of this legislation.
Thank you, Phil. Senator Stark.
Well, I certainly appreciate the work being done here. I've had a long connection with the industry. I've seen... let's get essentially out of the strawberry business. Over 100 million pounds when I started back in the 60s. Today, less than 30 million. We are struggling, and you get no taxes from these when they disappear, and we've seen a disappearance of large numbers of processors in the last 35 years. I really respect the work done here, and I'm hopeful that we can can improve profitability and the opportunity, not only for the processors, but for agriculture in the valley and in Oregon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Questions or comments? Senator Gary George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Katie. Katie, I'm looking at fresh fruit, vegetables, legumes, and seafood. Does it include hazelnut processing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, a quick run through my head. Yes, I believe that nuts are considered a fruit. By definition. So
okay.
I don't know.
Well, then I would have to declare a conflict of interest. But to follow up with what Senator Starr said, trying to collect taxes on an empty, vacated building is almost impossible. So I think it's necessary for us to keep, in fact, these businesses alive. And we personally experienced, as we took nothing and turned it into a processing plant, that the county was very eager to come out and look at rehabbed old junk machinery and put a real high price on it. So I know it can be a consequence to trying to even to begin a business as to what happens when they come out and try to establish values on machinery that you're trying to use to enhance the value of a product. So it's a tough business right now, extremely tough. We have a lot of disease problems in a lot of areas in addition to foreign competition. So I think I wish we could be stepping up as the governor of Washington has done. And I compliment her for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Supportive comments for Governor Gregoire of Washington. Other questions or comments for this panel? Thank you very much. I know you guys have worked incredibly hard to get us to where we are, and we appreciate it. And any letter, I think, will help inform everyone else in this building.
We'll get to work on it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Michelle Deister, anyone else want to get in on this? Joan, or am I going to go 0-for-4? Joan Bach declines the invitation to testify for the 14th time this session.
Mr. Chair.
This is perfect.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. I just need to put on the record that the League ultimately opposed converting this bill from an income tax credit to a property tax exemption. As I mentioned the other day, we do try to provide investment and expansion incentives to industry through participation in E-Zones. That's a program that marries job creation with these kind of property tax exemptions, and that's a trade-off that many communities that sponsor an E-Zone are willing to make. But I do want to very much acknowledge the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Revenue, and the food processors' hard work at targeting this exemption and making it administratively feasible. Just narrowing the applicability of the bill to those who are truly struggling, I think, will be helpful. But as Gil noted, it is a statewide problem, and to some extent, if the state feels that there's an exemption to be granted, it's helpful if the state can also provide some funding to support it. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jordan.
Every morning I drive in from West Salem, through West Salem, and I see that massive abandoned facilities out there. What is the tax consequences to cities? Did you guys calculate that to, you know, how much over the last 5 years that we've lost in revenue to the cities because of the closures of these plants? And it's not only here, it's Woodburn, it's all over the state. As we heard, Portland metropolitan area has a lot of these facilities.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there are tax consequences to these buildings closing. I won't deny it. And certainly that is something that, you know, our folks have been conscious of. We want to keep people employed in our community. You know, it's a situation where I think one industry versus another, there are plenty of deserving companies in any given area that might be struggling and need some help. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? 479. Close the work session on Senate Bill 479. And the last bill of the day we have is Senate Bill 427. And there's Steve.
So, committee, I think we have a couple of amendments that we're going to look at on this. Senator Metzger, do you want to...
Better than my original bill?
Well, not better, just different than you're improving upon.
Well, I appreciate your efforts to improve upon that.
Do you want to, Senator Metzger, do you want to talk a little bit about the original bill?
No, and that's not necessary. It's okay.
Now it is. That's what she thinks.
The original bill, Mr. Chair, was a transportation bill.
Correct.
It has now become a vehicle, so there is a symbiotic relationship between the original bill and where it's now going.
That's true. So, Steve, before us we have the high-cost disability language. Do you want to walk us through some of the high-cost disability in the committee? I asked for another amendment and would like to have a committee discussion on... My idea was to sunset the school formula in 3 years, which I don't think we can do, but would like to see where the committee's at in terms of some process that would be put in place in the interim that would just look at the whole formula and ask the question, is it getting us what we hope it would do? And so... If the committee's interested in that, I'll make another run at an amendment that passes constitutional muster, because just simply sunsetting the formula in 3 years, reasons unbeknownst to me,
it's in the letter,
we can't do. Steve, what on high-cost disability, this is our first hearing on the formula in quite some time.
Mr. Chair, you had a hearing on Senate Bill 427 about 2 months ago, I think, now. You had before you Senate Bill 427-1 amendments. Unfortunately, there was a miscommunication between myself and counsel, and the dash one isn't quite what was intended. The intent was that the amendment be the same as House Bill 2450, A engrossed, as it was passed by the House Revenue Committee and forwarded to the House Budget Committee. So this is part of that language is there, but the amended version is not, that the House adopted. So I'll get to that. Basically, what last session, when the legislature passed the high-cost disability grant within the school equalization formula, they put a sunset on it as of the end of 2004-05. And so for that to continue, the sunset has to be removed. The high-cost disability grant, as it's still in effect for 2004-05, says that all of the costs above $25,000 for each high-cost student is eligible for the high-cost disability grant. And at that $25,000 level, the total eligible cost was something like $17 million. And the maximum amount for the grant was $12 million, and so districts got less than the full reimbursement for those high costs above the $25,000. The House changed that $25,000. Besides removing the sunset, they changed the $25,000 to $30,000. And so now, so in their version, all of the costs above $30,000 for those high cost students would be eligible for the grant. That cut the total down to less than the $12 million maximum that was adopted in the 03 session. It was a little over $10 million, and so there. But that's 03-04 data, and so I would expect that will increase for 05-06, and so it will be somewhere probably between the 10 that's currently reported for 03-04 and the 12 that would be allowed. If this is continued, the $12 million for that total grant. So that's the part that's missing in the dash one, is raising the $25,000 to $30,000. If you look at the table at all that I provided you, the dash one for Senate Bill 427, it doesn't match with the dash one amendments, of course. And in doing those calculations for the high cost, I did use the $30,000 as the floor for that. And you'll see the total then just being slightly over $10 million statewide. The other provision in the House-adopted version, the A engrossed,
was to remove the sunset for the small high school supplemental fund. That's a special fund of $2.5 million per year for districts with small high schools. And you can see that also listed separately on that printout and the districts that would benefit from that. A small high school is a school that has less than 350 students if it has four grades, and less than 267 students if it's a three-grade high school. So there's some trade-offs in terms of the districts that are benefited or not benefited by those changes. So on that printout, the current law lines or columns assumes no small high school, $2.5 million set aside for that supplemental fund, and no high-cost disability grant at all, because that's current law after the sunset would take effect in 05-06. And then that compares then to having a small high school fund of $2.5 million total per year, and having the high-cost disability formula continue with a $30,000 floor. And also I have used the Senate's appropriation of $5.325 billion for the state school fund in running the formula numbers here. So just to make you aware of that. And I think that's about it. 80 districts benefit from the high cost or receive revenue under the high cost disability grant in the formula. 99 districts qualify for the small high school supplemental fund allocation. And that is allocated based upon each district's share of ADM relative to the total for the small high school districts.
Mr. Chairman?
So there's really three questions. High-cost disability, and we should make sure everyone's clear, because I don't think, if everyone is, fantastic. If not, because of last session, I don't think everyone was on revenue, any of the current members. So we should walk through and do a good, thorough on what high-cost disability, the changes we made to better reimburse districts for the high-cost disability students that they have. The small high school kind of set aside outside the formula, and then the third, just a general formula conversation. So those three areas would be, I think, the ones most germane. Senator George.
What's the total number of districts that are in the minus category?
Let's see. It's fairly, fairly evenly split. I think it was 110 that show a gain, and about that would leave, 88 that would show a loss.
Okay, thanks.
Although this will change, because I don't think our amendments came back.
But this the numbers reflect the amendments as intended. Mm-hmm. So the numbers had the 30,000 floor for the high-cost disability grant.
Okay. Other questions, and then Senator Brzezinski, we'll go into more detail just on the high-cost disability.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to be more more inquiring. I want more inquiries on the small high school fund.
Okay.
Because I'm glancing at some of the districts that are in my Senate district, and I would assume that they should be qualifying for small high school fund, but they're showing zero. So that might be something I need to do with staff at a later time. But I just want to get a clarification as to how both of those things are tied together or working.
And like high cost disability, that is also sunsetted at this point.
Okay.
So let's get into it. So Steve, can we back up and just talk more about, and I'm happy to, but you're the expert on high cost disability and kind of where the legislature, I know Senator Farrelly led an interim group 3 years ago that helped forward this legislation that we passed last session. Can we kind of back up and kind of go to how we got to the point last session that we made the change, and I don't know if we have any visuals on just kind of the changes that were made to the high-cost disability and what problem the legislature was hoping to solve.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any visuals. There was... The high-cost disability students are the IEP students, or those students that have individualized education programs.
Right.
Those are students that also qualify for the double weight in the formula.
In the formula, my understanding, we're funding an 11%? Or 13?
The number of IEPs that can be weighted is limited to 11% of the students, or the ADM, without going through the waiver, without having a waiver.
Without having a waiver. So, right.
So you, they can have more than 11% if they qualify for the waiver.
So just using South Lane County, which is Cottage Grove area, they have 19% of their student body would qualify, but they're only being funded 11%. My understanding, what I'm hearing, Steve, is there's a way that they can actually go through a waiver process to potentially get more money in if they meet other qualifications?
Yes.
And how many districts have bailed themselves that way? So what Eugene has, 13% are IEP. They've bumped up to that 11%. Do we know, did they go through the waiver and did other districts?
I'd have to look at that data. I don't have that with me. Okay. But they probably did. Because there were a lot of districts that qualified for the waiver, but I don't have a count with me. So they, there were districts that were saying that they were spending a lot more on those special education students than what the double weight would grant them through the formula. And those districts typically were students, were districts with students that were in urban areas where there were other services available for those students besides education services. And so the Portland-type school districts had a higher percent of the high-cost students than the state average. And so they were spending quite a bit more than the double weight on those students. And so the interim group reviewed that and proposed then that districts be eligible for those high costs as a new grant in the formula. And it was set at the cost above $25,000. So the district is getting the standard weight of about $5,000 for that student. It's getting another $5,000 for the double weight. It's then having to fund between that $10,000 and the next $15,000 to get up to the $25,000, and then everything over $25,000 is eligible for the grant, but it wasn't fully funded at a $25,000 floor.
And is that because the $12 million was exhausted? So $12 million.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The total was about $17 million, but the legislation adopted specified that a maximum of $12 million a year could be allocated to that grant.
So the proposal here...
I was going to add, at the $25,000 floor, not only is the total about 17 million, I think the total number of students was about little over 2,000 that qualified as meeting the 25,000 floor. With the 30,000 floor, it was about half that number of little, about 1,000 students that would qualify. That's why the cost then came down from 17 million to 10 million in 03-04. Or would have come down if it had been 30,000 in 03-04. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter then of whether you want to, leave the $12 million and partially fund with the $25,000 floor, or leave the $12 million, raise it to 30,000 and fully fund at least initially, or potentially raise the $12 million.
To bump it to 17 or 20, which fully reimburse. Senator George.
I feel like we're shuffling the chairs on the Titanic example again. The districts are required by law to meet the needs of those students, so we're really just kind of moving dollars around with what we're doing here. We're trying to deny that we really have an obligation to take it on up to equal the total cost above that reasonable number, because as you point out, the district's going to have that 15 over the 10 before they got to 25. Now we're going to go to 30, so they're going to have to pick up the difference. Correct?
Yes. Right. Yes, there's nothing in the numbers here that changed the total amount available to school districts.
Right.
It's a matter of how it's distributed.
In some ways, sure. In the ideal world, the federal government would fully reimburse, and we would also fully reimburse, and there wouldn't be that gap.
That's right.
We'd get $17 million and eliminate that gap in between.
Mr. Chairman, when I had those hearings on special ed a few years ago, it was kind of shocking to really see where we were in relationship to our obligation to the federal government, the little bit that they send back, the percentage they promised, and now, of course, we have the same thing with No Child Left Behind. We have the money left behind, mm-hmm. and it's putting here, we're trying to shift a little bit of a burden onto the local district with a little bit of other dollars they have, and you wonder where the children who have special needs are left.
Yeah, that's why the issue keeps coming back. I'm glad we sunset it, though. At least it brought back this discussion to this legislature right. with the hope that we may be able to do more. And that's why we've scheduled Senate Bill 427 to help highlight that. And the House has acted on this. It's just it's now part of the wreckage of the split up of Ways and Means, so it's just kind of lying there. Other questions for Steve on high-cost disability? Okay, so let's move to the small high school and kind of the rationale and why that was kind of set aside outside the formula.
Mr. Chair, there is in the formula a small school correction weight that adds weights to those districts that have small high schools. Let me point out one additional criteria is that the school district has to have less than 8,500 ADMW to qualify. So that's the limit on the size of the district. And so I don't know if those small high schools are in districts larger than that or not that you mentioned. But and it has to have existed as a small high school in 1999. So it's not where a district can take an existing high school and split it up and to qualify for small high schools. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of locked into those that currently exist.
And the requirement to qualify as a small high school, you said 350 students in the high school if they offer 3 grades or 4 grades?
The 350 was for 4 grades.
And for 3 grades?
267 is the maximum.
So I look at Bethel School District in Lane County, which is a 4A school, and it shows that they're getting a small high school fund of $20,377. And I'm trying to figure out how they would be tapping in the small school fund, high school fund. I'm apparently probably misinterpreting what I'm seeing, but
I'd have to look at the small high school list to know which one that is.
Okay. I mean, it's Willamette High School.
Oh, just one high school in the district?
Yeah. I think that's the only one that's in the district. But we can go over that. I'm trying to grasp this because I look at, like, Fern Ridge, which is in Lane County as well, and it looks like they have nothing coming in as a small high school fund, and they're getting ready under this proposal to take a $30,000-plus hit. And they definitely have very few students. They have to qualify. I think what I'm going to do is just take this and have it faxed out to my school districts and have them give me some feedback because I'm not grasping the continuity based on what I think the definitions are and how the impact is, except that maybe by taking the $25,000 and you're moving it to $30,000, you're putting that obligation on the schools, and they're going to be losing their money based on picking up that additional $5,000 before they get to benefit under the formula, as Senator George was saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezinski, if you get that information from the districts, we can compare that to what I have from the Department of Education.
Thank you.
Then, in the discussion last session, there was concern that the districts with small high schools, even with the small school correction weight, wasn't generating quite enough money for them to offer a comparable program to larger districts with larger high schools. And also kind of as a something for the small districts, since they tended not to benefit from the high cost disability grant being addition in the formula, this was kind of a counterweight to that to help both the small districts and the larger districts with that legislation.
And Steve, how do we get that variation in the formula where you'll have, well, Sherwood's always the example, where Sherwood gets, I don't know what it is, such a low, well, the lowest in the state per pupil, and another district will get, Oregon just did a story on this, 45 or 50,000. How do we get such a wide swing of per pupil embedded in the formula?
Mr. Chair, I have not looked at the detail for that district, but it could be the teacher experience factor in terms of their being significantly under the state average. It could be in their transportation costs.
Poverty.
It could be in their weighting, poverty factor, ESL students, IEP students. I don't know how they compare in those categories to the state average. And I doubt that they receive anything from the facility grant. So it's some combination of those factors then that would make their dollars per weighted student lower.
It's relatively more affluent community, less poverty, less ESL. They just don't have the student waiting that many of the other districts have because they're high growth district as well. They added a lot of young teachers. So I think all of those factors put them in a really tough position as far as how do we maintain programs with the rate of growth that we're experiencing. Both Representative Kermel and I have tried to find some extra dollars for that district because of the fact that they are funded at such a disproportionate level and high growth and on top of that.
It's, I'm now reminded that you represent Sherwood is always the example that we hear about. Well, one of the ideas I had that we can kick around because obviously we're not going to move this bill today is there some process that we'd like to set up that we would revisit the whole formula given that it's a tough discussion because you're just moving existing dollars, you're not adding anything, you're just looking at the whole formula, but it's something I would be interested in, and the committee can kind of kick that around and let me know if I hate task forces though, and so that might be what we're stuck with, and I just task forces in general are just most painful experience. I don't want to be on it if there is one on the school funding formula. Does anyone want to testify on high cost disability, the small school, or putting in process something that would, that's what we're going to look at. We're going to obviously have to bring back a more perfected amendment. Please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And as Steve suggested, the components about which you're talking this morning were added by the O3 legislature following an interim study of both high-cost disability, the cost of providing services to students with disabilities, as well as the needs of small school districts, particularly those trying to operate small high schools. And the high-cost disabilities grant, I've tried to describe it as an insurance program. That is, every school district in the state, because we're taking money out of the formula, pays what I call a premium. And this premium is intended to purchase insurance for those school districts that happen to have students with extraordinary high-cost needs. There are a number of school districts, Eugene, for example, that has a student with very high cost, very extraordinary needs that has to be, that costs over $100,000 a year, that has to be placed in some kind of special out-of-district program. And so it's not, it would not be uncommon for a school district, a small school district, for example, to receive one of those students and be forced under federal and state law to provide services to that student. It could near bankrupt that school district. So the idea was that every school district would pay a premium to purchase this insurance. And the deductible for that insurance under the current law was $25,000. So the school district would provide the services for that student up to $25,000, and then any amount in excess, they would be reimbursed. Well, because of the number of students over 25,000 and the amount of money available, that level of reimbursement has been about 70%. And so in discussing this issue in the House committee, and based on some data that was gathered by the Department of Education, it was decided to increase that deductible to 30,000 so that the excess cost would be reimbursed at 100%. And this provides greater protection and greater assistance to school districts in serving those needs with those students with high-cost disabilities. So that was the idea of moving from 25 to 30 to increase the reimbursement. As I said, every school district, and that's why it shows a loss for those school districts that don't have any of these students, every school district in the state is in effect paying the premium, but they are protected against those extraordinary costs should they receive one of those students. The Small School Supplement Fund, as Steve suggested, was intended, and based on the work during the interim prior to last legislative session, was intended to recognize that small school districts, particularly those that are trying to maintain a comprehensive program in a small high school, was very difficult. And so it was intended to try to provide some special assistance. We know that high schools cost more than elementary schools. With elementary schools, you can combine grades, et cetera. But in order to provide a comprehensive, broad program for high school students, it could cost more. And particularly in small rural school districts, isolated school districts, trying to run small high schools that don't have merger or consolidation options, this provides a great deal of assistance. And the other change that was made last legislative session was to increase the transportation grant. It was recognized that there were some school districts out there, because of their size and isolation and geography, that they had extraordinarily high cost transportation or high transportation costs per student. So for those school districts in the top tier, that is the most expensive, and I think it was about the top 10% of school districts, we increased that reimbursement rate from 70% to 90%, and then the next tier from 70 to 80. So all of these were packaged together, as Steve suggested, to both help the small school districts trying to run small high schools, as well as other school districts that have the high-cost disability students. And it's interesting to note that the extraordinary high-cost students with disabilities, their parents tend to live in more urban areas just because there may be other medical services or other specialized programs for those students. So it's unusual that you see many of the extremely high-cost students in districts outside the metro areas, but there's always that possibility, and that's why the concept was created to protect all school districts against those extraordinary costs.
Questions for John?
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, just to express support for the amendments, and also, if I may, to answer a question posed by Senator Prusansky on Bethel. I placed a quick call over there, and that $20,000 is for their second high school.
They're all the alternative.
Yeah, Colquia. So.
Great.
Yes, sir.
Is the premium high enough? Should we not be putting $15 million instead of $12 million into this set-aside? We're still penalizing those districts with large numbers of those students to make up that difference between the double weighting and the 30,000, or even 20,000, 25,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I mean, obviously you can play around with putting more money into the pot beyond the amount currently allocated. That would obviously increase the premium, but then If you move from $25,000 to $30,000, you're already at a 100% reimbursement. I think the question is, do you want to lower, if you increase the premium, then you can, do you want to lower the deductible? And any time you're dealing with the distribution formula and you're distributing a limited amount of resources, any time you increase an amount that goes to a particular set of school districts, then you're decreasing the amount available for all the other school districts that may not benefit from that. And that often becomes a rather difficult politically just because you're moving money around.
I guess I recognize that, the difficulty, but it seems to me that these districts that have that are receiving large amounts of this money are also paying large amounts for the difference between what they receive in the formula and the $25,000 or $30,000 limit. So if they're receiving lots of dollars to make up above that, they're also giving up or spending a lot of dollars. So I think it's a real tough proposition to find a balance there that doesn't disadvantage the districts that have high numbers of these severely disabled.
Senator, it's always a balance between the amount of premium you're willing to pay versus those initial out-of-costs that you're required to come up with.
100%.
I've got a couple of questions or comments, I guess. One, I want to follow up with Senator Starr. I mean, I'm thinking from some of the examples I've received from school districts within my district, and I'll use the South Lane one again because that's one I think I can articulate more accurately. If they have the high-cost disability students with a percentage of their population being 18 or 19%, they're only getting 11%. We're now going to basically say, before you even get your reimbursement, we're going to charge you another $5,000. I mean, I'm here saying that we should be paying those school districts for every student they have that's above and beyond that, the full amount. I mean, we're already asking the locals to take on that extra cost that's above and beyond. In that case, it's almost double what they're being actually paid for. Mm-hmm. And then we're basically going to move the chairs on the Titanic to a different level that they even have to pay more to even get the benefit they're going to get for that 11% they're getting. And that's just a comment. The other concern I hear from more of the small rural school districts is that they have a lot of timberland that's in their districts that has the deep tax deferrals on it. And they don't get their money until there's something actually done with that, the timber on that land that's actually extracted and processed. It almost seems to me we need to be looking at a different formula for them as to giving them some type of money to continue to operate and be there as a small school district in these rural communities while the money they're, quote-unquote, banking on is out there in the field. And, I mean, I don't know if that's ever been discussed at this in this building, but it was astonishing to me after getting appointed in the end of 2003, talking to school districts and superintendents and hearing that they weren't able to even make certain adjustments in their programs because they don't have the money. Then we start looking at what their tax base includes. And it's one of those things that it's not that I'm against giving those deferrals. It's just that it seems like it's an undue hardship on those school districts to even be able to function when they don't have any type of tax base to actually pull on because it's all in deferment.
Sounds to me like he's wanting to get on this task force.
Red right screen. Well, Steve, if we could look at, based on Senator Starr and Senator Brzezinski's comments, if we could look at what it would mean to drop the cap back down to 25, bump the fund up, and look at it, I guess it's on Senator George's point too, of what it would be to fully, or more fully, it's not going to be fully, but more fully reimburse
the high-cost districts. And feel free to work with Senator Starr, Senator Brzezinski on. But I think it's good for this committee to look at. It's harder. I mean, there's several things within the formula that I think that ought to be looked at. It's harder, I think, towards the end of the session, given we all look at the runs. So far, I've yet to do it, but I will on my area and see how it does. And that just makes it more difficult because it's hard to vote. Senator Starr is a good example. His district just tends to lose, or Sherwood tends to lose just about on every scenario. And that's why I think you have to have a whole formula conversation of you've got definitely, I think, a cost of doing business issue where you have a teacher that's compensated at $40,000 in one district where the price of housing is $500,000, you know, average mean house is $300,000. In another district, the mean house is $100,000. And the formula makes no accommodation for the real incredible variance in cost of doing business. But my thought is that those conversations are going to have to occur in the interim because I think it's tough. But a high-cost disability is one that I think we could do. We have to do it this time because we've sunsetted. Other thoughts or comments on this this issue? We'll bring it back probably next week with a more perfected amendment. And, Steve, if we could look at the schedule for this Thursday.
Yes.
Does that give us enough time to, well, if you have time, we'll bring it back Thursday if Steve has time to kind of run the math on better reimbursing these districts. And any other thoughts people have, we can schedule it next week also. Anything else? Tomorrow, so we're up for the entire week. Tomorrow we have... Okay, so Senator Metzger will have 171. We can get updated. We got 2197, which is the tourism issue that we had the week before, and then 593, which is a conservation easement bill that we just received about a week ago in revenue. So we'll be back at 9 tomorrow, and then a full day on Thursday also, and then no meeting on Friday.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will close the work session on 427 and Sharon Reddy.